Welcome to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. This is Chester Moore. When the coronavirus hit really hard in 2020 and travel was being shut down, I decided I was going to get my fly fishing gear out and teach myself how to fly fish again. Oh, I could do the basics, but I really hadn't pursued fly fishing at any level in close to 20 years. So when I did that, a whole different world of fishing was opened up to me. And one of the people that I met was Chris Johnson of Living Waters Fly Shop. And he's in the Austin area. And I had the most amazing conversation with him about catching rainbow trout in Texas. And then I spoke with him again more recently and had an incredible talk, not only about rainbow trout, but native trout to Texas. You gotta hear this. And today we have a very special guest. We have Mr. Chris Johnson from Living Waters Fly Fishing in Round Rock, Texas. How you doing, Chris?
Doing quite well. Thanks for the invite to be on.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. We got connected by Therese Thompson from the Western Native Trout Initiative, and with a common interest in native trout species in America. And we really first got connected because of a common interest, which you're way further along in than me, with the Rio Grande cutthroat.
Absolutely. That's one of the fish I enjoy chasing the most on the fly.
Well, let's start there real quick, because what got me going on this, I was talking to her on the phone about this Western Native Trout Initiative, and I said, man, I sure wish we had a native trout here in Texas. She goes, well, you did. And talked about the Rio Grande cutthroat, and it rang a bell to something I very early in my career had read about but never studied up, that there was this native trout that's still native to New Mexico and Colorado that was probably 99.9% out there in the Trans-Pecos as a native fish. And we talked the other day, and you said that you even went out to some of these locations. So can you tell us some about the Rio Grande cutthroat?
Certainly. As it pertains to Texas, the species, you know, there's some debate on whether or not it was here or not. I personally believe that it was.
Yeah.
And I just think there's a lot of evidence slanting in that direction. I know the Texas Parks and Wildlife, you can actually dig a little bit on their website, and I think they still have the publication written by Gary Garrett and Gary Matlock.
Yeah, 1991.
Makes the argument for native trout in Texas. And some of the evidence is it's pretty strong, including they found you know, trout scales and fossilized Native American droppings and things like that. There were also some reports of kind of Civil War era reports of guys doing wildlife surveys. The Everman report that went through there. It's interesting because the color plates that were used in that study were actually from parts of Colorado that I fished. So apparently, you know, it's one of those things that the debate is, well, did they know what they were looking at? And in this study, the color plates were actually from the southern portion of Colorado where I go fish quite a bit. So the thought is that they knew what they were looking at, and that even you know, even though they're not here now, that at one time we probably had a native salmonid in the state of Texas. So that's pretty incredible to think about.
Yeah, I grew up thinking that the native trout of Texas was Cynocyne nebulosus, the spotted sea trout, the speckled trout, and the sand trout, and the gulf trout. Of course, they are not true trout in the salmonoid kind of way that we talked about. But it's exciting to think that in the fairly recent past, we had these native trout here. But doing the digging that I did for an article I wrote at higher calling.net, learned that there was some water issues that caused, and some development issues and things that caused these fish to no longer live here.
So there's a myriad of things that can kind of contribute to that. The part, I think, that the water issue being the fact that, you know, things change. I mean, if you go out to Drifting Springs right now, you can go find my great-grandparents at a place out there, and you could find clam fossils and things like that.
Yep.
all throughout those fields, and it's crazy. So, I mean, you can find, you know, oceanic fossils all throughout Central Texas.
Sure.
You know that, obviously, climate change, environment change. I mean, we have woolly mammoth fossils right up the road in Waco and all around. So, I mean, there was once an entirely different climate. And so I think what wound up happening is at this point, you know, a lot of the places like the Devil's River, where they found some evidence, but like at the Baker Cave area, you know, Olympia Creek is another one over the Davis Mountains that they highly suspect had them in more recent past. And then, of course, McKittrick Creek in the Guadalupe Mountains National Park area, that still has a wild reproducing population of rainbow trout that were introduced probably about 100 years ago. But have managed to persist. So the water technically still can support trout. They're just not our native fish that were here at one time. So at this point, water, I think, is, you know, kind of receded. Habitat is extraordinarily limited. To say that we don't have any is probably a falsehood, and the fact that we still have a wild population of rainbows in Guadalupe Mountain National Park, but by and large, we don't really have the habitat we wanted for this fish.
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the things. I think in terms of wildlife, people understand habitat more than aquatic habitat. You know, I think sometimes there's a disconnect. When people see water, they think, well, this fish must still be able to flourish here. Not necessarily, because you can even have the water in some occasions, but maybe with certain trout, you don't have the right amount of flow. You don't have the right habitat, the right vegetation growing. So there's a lot of factors that go in aquatic habitat.
There are. And with this species specifically, it has to kind of have a ripple run pool environment where there is a little bit of, spawning opportunities and good substrate for that. It also has to have, nice, cool, clean water that does stay cold on a year-round basis, which is something that we have a lot of springs in Texas. But as far as that actual trout cold water, that's pretty hard to come by in Texas at large. So it's one of the things that I think has really limited the opportunities for this species within the state. But I think the only viable water we currently have, and there was a grassroots reintroduction effort that was actually put forth by Texas Parks and Wildlife and Guadalupe River Trout Unlimited to see and explore the option of reintroducing the Rio Grande cutthroat back to Texas in McKittrick Creek at one point. So.
But, the trout thing is fascinating in Texas because, I remember the very first, stockings going into the Guadalupe River and then when kind of the Canyon Lake tail race thing started kicking off. And I remember thinking, man, that's just really, really incredible because here I am thinking I'm going to have to go to, Montana or somewhere, or even up in Arkansas to catch me a nice rainbow trout. And then we had this pretty incredible fishery and a gigantic Trout Unlimited movement based around the Guadalupe River.
Absolutely. It's actually still currently the largest chapter of Trout Unlimited in the world.
It's mind-boggling, man.
I served on the board of that chapter for several years and still very involved with the chapter. And we're very involved with Trout Unlimited as a national organization, as a business. We're actually a Trout Unlimited gold level business here at Living Waters. So doing conservation efforts, of course, very near and dear to our heart. But the tailwater fishery below Canyon Lake, that's incredible. We guided through the store. And a lot of people don't realize this, but not all those trout die in the summer. A lot of those actually can oversummer if the water conditions are favorable, which some years they very much are. And we do have some wild fish in the river that were actually spawned in the Guadalupe River itself. And so you have these first generation wild fish that are showing up on the scene. And it's incredible to see. It's something you'd never in your wildest dreams think you'd find in Central Texas.
Well, speaking of that, how people say Guadalupe tail, the Canyon Lake tail race and all this stuff, how big of an area is this that you say is an effective trout fishery? I mean, they can possibly sustain them through, like, say, a regular normal summer period.
A lot of it does depend on the flow and just kind of the year we're having. But I would say on average year-in, year-out basis, effectively the first 4 to 5 miles really sustains the fish from in the form of like a temperature refuge where that daytime water temp does not eclipse 70 degrees. There are some things that do make it, as with any fishery, there are a few wild cards. And within the Guadalupe River, the type of fish that are actually stocked by Guadalupe River Trout Unlimited, those come out of Crystal Lake Fisheries out of Avon, Missouri. And that's actually the Emerson strain of rainbow trout, which was bred to be temperature tolerant. And in talks with the hatchery out there, they've done some temperature trials on those fish where select specimens have actually weathered daytime water temps in the 80s.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable. That's unheard of in the trout world. That's not every fish they stock, but a few of them will make it. So I've heard it said that there will always be trout in the Guadalupe tail race. No matter if there's flood or drought or whatever. And so far that has proved to be true. Even after the major floods where that water's coming out of the dam at well over 70 degrees Fahrenheit, there's still trout in the tail race. It's just absolutely incredible.
Nah, that's a great story. And it's something that has brought anglers together. And I don't know of a type of fish on the globe that spawns the kind of ferocious conservation ethic of trout. Even down to like how you handle the fish, there's a lot of things out there. Maybe people who grew up fishing on the coast have a completely different mindset maybe than the guys out there. I was in Montana last September.
When we come back, we'll talk more with Chris Johnson
on fly fishing in Texas. Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. You can listen to the podcast of the program by going to KLVI.com, clicking on the podcast link at the top of the page. Now we're going to talk more with Chris Johnson on fly fishing, trout, and native trout in Texas.
There's a lot of things out there. Maybe people who grew up fishing on the coast have a completely different mindset maybe than the guys out there. I was in Montana last September watching people fish in a stream, and it was almost a scientific effort, you know? And so it's really exciting to me in my home state to have this great fishery and people that maybe they can't travel out west or to be able to go do something like this. I've been fortunate. I've caught like a 13-pound brown trout in New York, and, you know, I've caught pretty nice rainbows up in Little Red River in Arkansas and all those kind of things. But a lot of people, man, if they can just go out there and catch a fish, so they can book trips with you.
Yeah, we do run those through the store. Obviously, during for the Guadalupe River specifically for trout, we run those in kind of the winter months, kind of the November through, you know, March, April timeframe, kind of our peak season. But yeah, we stay pretty booked up. It's a busy season.
Well, make sure and hook these up with these guys, because it's a great opportunity and go learn that water and learn from the experts and greatly enhance your opportunity catching some of these tremendous fish. Now, when people want to go trout fishing, maybe they're going to do like we talked about a few weeks ago, take up the Utah Native Trout Slam, or go out and try to get them a Rio Grande cutthroat or Yellowstone cutthroat or something like that. In terms of conservation ethic, I mean, like a guy wants a great picture of a fish, what are some of the handling tips you can give us for making sure that the fish released actually live?
So obviously, as with any catch and release, I don't think anything's ever 100% successful, but there's some things that can be, you know, huge contributing factors for the survival of the fish and really, really help with the mortality rate. So first off, you know, when you catch a fish, play it as quickly as possible. You know, I know a lot of people love to feel a fish bite, and it's a lot of fun to watch them, you know, swim back and forth and do all that. But for the safety of the fish, we recommend once you hook it, you know, put the wood to him, try to get him in the net as quickly as possible. And that's the other thing, is use a net. There's a lot of great products out there. We don't really recommend the ones that are kind of like the nylon netting that has all the knots and stuff in it. You'll typically see those down on the coast quite a bit.
Yep.
We use clear rubberized nets or stuff that's kind of like a rubberized coating on it, to where it actually does not remove the slime off the fish. We just want to do as much as we can to kind of keep that fish in as good a shape as it can be. And then if we have to hold the fish or touch the fish, which, I mean, a lot of people want to do that for pictures. I'm no different. I like to take pictures of the fish. But we keep those in the water as much as possible. We'll try to keep the fish with its belly touching the water, keep our hands totally wet. Kind of the little motto is keep them wet. And there's a whole movement that's actually centered around that. And then trout are, you know, it's amazing how resilient they are on the actual, like, habitat front and some of the places that they live. But they're actually pretty sensitive when interacting with anglers. And, you know, a trout, if you keep it out of the water for 10 to 12 seconds, and that's any species of trout, you can do permanent damage to their gills. And that's why we really tell folks, this isn't a catfish that you can, you know, leave it on the bank, flopping around, doing all this stuff, and then try to let it go and it's still okay. This is something that, you know, some care does need to be taken for the fish, and especially with species like Rio Grande cutthroat, where they're technically listed as a threatened species. They're not endangered, and we're fighting tooth and nail to keep them off that list. But they are threatened, so therefore they do deserve our respect and care.
What happens threatened to endangered in terms of fishing?
So that's an incredibly great question, and it has kind of a long answer, but I'll keep it as short as I can. You know, a threatened species still allows a lot of your state entities and, you know, forest entities, tribal agencies and entities, and also, you know, anglers and conservation chapters, things like that, to be a part of the story of this fish, to actually, the conservation is something that, you know, yourself and myself, that we can involve ourselves in and, you know, actually be boots on the ground for some of this stuff. You know, I've been up there and, you know, planted willows and sedges alongside creeks, and, you know, we've done, you know, a lot for education and, you know, photographing this fish and, you know, making films about it, raising money and doing all sorts of stuff. It allows us to be part of that story. When it goes endangered, it really kind of ties your hands on some of the fishing aspects of us being actually able to enjoy the fish. But it also can tie your hands on a federal level as well, making funding kind of hard to get sometimes. And even just the state involvement and some of the management that can be, you know, that takes place there, it just gets a little bit tougher. So if we can keep that off the list, then that's something that we've still got a you know, a threatened fish that only occupies approximately, you know, somewhere between, it's about 11 to 12% of its native range, somewhere in there.
Sure.
So it's minuscule compared to what it used to be. But it's still doing well. We do have a lot of populations that are persisting. As of 2016, I believe it was, the range was at 11%, and there were 129 populations that were in existence that were like conservation populations.
Well, that's great. You know, basically, you have a fish here that's unfortunately been extirpated from 89% of its range, it seems like. But in some of the areas where it still exists, it sounds like you're having some thriving populations and things like that. It's like I do a lot with wild sheep, and there are some areas with thriving wild sheep, but then you have entire hundreds of miles of habitat that are barren. You know, it's a very similar thing in terms of what's going on the land versus what's going on down in the water. And you mentioned something earlier to me that was interesting. You mentioned a strain of rainbow trout that was specifically brought from a hatchery in Missouri, I believe, into Texas. Is that a created strain in hatcheries, or is that a subspecies?
So oddly enough, without going too much into trout taxonomy and biology, mm-hmm. which I don't have a degree in this. I'm just an absolute nerd.
Me too. I'm the same way. That's why I ask these questions.
No, so I apologize if it starts getting a little nerdy, but at the same time, it's one of the things I'm very passionate about. In terms of rainbow trout, there's really, in the lower 48,
mm-hmm.
You're looking at all current day rainbow trout that are stocked. For the most part, you can trace that back to a common ancestor of the McLeod River red band trout in Northern California. And I've actually been there to actually catch those in their actual native range. It's an incredibly beautiful fish, and it looks nothing like what you and I picture a rainbow trout. Mm-hmm. There's some similarities, but not that much in the small creeks. It actually looks a little bit more like kind of a cross between a cutthroat and a golden trout, and that it looks more like that in many of the drainages that I've fished them in.
Wow.
But the thing that's interesting with that fish is that those are the ones that were transported and propagated and bred and raised. And so as you have, you know, the current day rainbow trout, if you wanted to look at it this way, it's great, 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 or a whole lot more greats than their grandfather and grandmother were all the McLeod River red bands.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actual true, you know, like the Alaskan rainbows, like
yeah.
the leopard rainbow. That itself, that's a native rainbow. That's something that, you know, they've got steelhead up there in Alaska. I actually have a brother that lives in Alaska, so part him and his family, he lives up there. And so that whole ecosystem is completely different. You're looking at, you've got a nadrima fish, you've got, you know, fish that remain in stream. You've got some stuff that gets landlocked over years. It's just strange to see all the different dynamics of all that. But nonetheless, the native rainbows are only going to be on the pretty much the western seaboard. You'll see like yep. anywhere steelhead are, you know, which is California, Oregon, Washington,
British Columbia,
Idaho, stuff yeah. like that. Exactly, all the way into Alaska. That's where steelhead run. That's the extent of the rainbow trout.
Yep.
All the eastern states, all the stuff like, you know, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas,
stocked.
You know, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, there is nothing, no native rainbows in there at all. And there's actually, a lot of people don't realize this, there's not a single native brown trout to the U.S.
Yeah, they're European, right? They're from Europe, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah.
There were two strains. There was the Von Bar strain and the Loch Leven strain. One was from Germany, the other one was from Scotland. So you're looking at those two strains were brought in, stocked in different places. One was more of a river strain, and one was more of a lake bred strain. And now the current day brown trout that we have is, of course, you know, the ancestor of all of that. But and brook trout, which obviously persist, they're probably the largest threat to high elevation cutthroat trout. I jokingly call them the cockroach of the West. They are beautiful in their native range, and they deserve protection. Everything that we do for cutthroat and just to protect them and to celebrate that species, I think the brook trout deserves every bit of that within their native range. It's a fish worth protecting. It's borderline sacred in its native range, and especially if you're in the Northeast. And I've caught them up there as well, and they're beautiful. It's an incredible fish. But in the West, they just flat out don't belong there. They're introduced.
Look, so, I got a bunch of me and my redneck friends. If there's a bag limit, dude, we'll show up and, you know, we'll put some on the grill, dude.
So, oh, man, no, I mean, that's camp food around our place.
Exactly.
The thing that's really cool, like, that's actually one of the conservation efforts is the San Luis Valley chapter of Trout Unlimited, which is right there in southern central Colorado. They meet in Alamosa. They actually have a creek that they've invested in. A good friend of mine, Kevin Terry, has done a lot of, livestock exposures to keep the elk and the livestock out from overgrazing and trampling down the stream banks to kind of have the habitat restoration on that creek. And they're finding now that the cutthroat are actually seem to they're rebounding pretty well.
When we come back on More Outdoors, we'll talk more with Chris Johnson of Living Waters Fly. Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. This is Chester Moore. We're going to be talking and finishing our conversation here with Chris Johnson of Living Waters Fly Shop.
I heard at one of the check stations on the upper river right now, it's looking at about 1 in 3 fish or cutthroats, when that was not anywhere close to that number a few years ago. So it's awesome. But they're actually doing a conservation effort this summer where their members are competing for a really nice rod and reel combo. I know it's nice because we donated it, so I got to pick it up myself.
You.
But the thing that was cool is they're going to be competing for that, and they're keeping limits of brook trout. So that's what they're doing to help the cutthroat out. They're just simply pulling trout from the river and going to take them home and have a nice dinner.
Hey, nothing wrong with that, man. I love to eat trout. Trout's incredible. The last trout I caught was in New York last year, some small brown trout, and it was like in a gully by some people's house. I went turkey hunting with friends of mine, and my friend doesn't fish, but one of his friends fish. I'm like, dude, you live by the Finger Lakes and Lake Ontario and all these streams, you don't fish. What's wrong with you, you know? And so you can't turkey hunt in the evenings there. So I spent my evenings fishing, and I'm catching these like little 1 pound brown trout in like a little ditch by some guy's house. And you know, they knew they were stocked, but I was talking to some locals there that really had no idea that there are no brown trout native to the U.S. and kind of thought these fish are all native to New York because they've been there as long as they have, you know. So I think it's interesting to let people know that we've done things to enhance fisheries and make things great. I mean, like the Little Red River in Arkansas, what an incredible, fun fishery to go to. But it's also important to look at what the good Lord put in America, you know, and take those native fish that we have and prioritize them in terms of conservation.
And that's absolutely correct. And that's one of the things that I know you mentioned that we got connected by Therese Thompson, who's a dear friend of mine with Western Native Trout Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I really just have to sing the praises of that organization. You know, Trout Unlimited, they have a very broad focus on the fact that it is cold, clean, fishable water. And while there's a very, very large emphasis on native fish, you know, there's also the emphasis on the recreational
sure.
tailwater fisheries and
yeah.
things like that as well. Because, I mean, it's kind of the something for everybody, but that's the part where Western Native Trout Initiative just focus, that their sole focus is on what actually is, you know, intrinsic to the U.S. and especially the Western states as it concerns them. And that's the part where they pour 100% of their efforts into nothing but native species. And that's the part that I just absolutely adore them for. They do such a great job of it.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. We have our ministry, and one of the things we do, we call Higher Calling Wild Wishes Expeditions, and we've taken our second trip out to Central Texas to take basically our native trout, the Guadalupe bass, you know, a native bass out there. And we took the kids out, and we were having them use their social media to talk about native fish in Texas and, you know, problems with hybridization with smallmouth and stream problems and things like that. So, you know, if you look into all these states, most of these states have some kind of a native fish that, you know, that maybe something else is disagreeing with that we've introduced, and it's a good time to reflect on that and prioritize the things that are here first, and also realize, hey, there's nothing wrong with having these wonderful, incredible trout fisheries all around America and enjoying that. Because, you know, we spoke the other day, and like, I dig a bunch of people going out fishing. I may not necessarily like them on my hole all the time, but I like seeing people out there, because the more people, the better voice we're going to have at Congress when there's a Clean Water Act, or when there's grants going to be out for clean screening and things like that. The more people behind it, the bigger the voice is going to be. And in the end of the day, the better the fishery is going to be.
100%. And I mean, and that's something I know that you and I have chatted before. That conservation, I mean, it's sad that it's been dovetailed into becoming solely a political issue.
Sure, man.
And it's not that at all. It's all about heart. And I mean,
no doubt.
We say this a lot, where lovers will always work harder than workers. So, I mean, if you cherish a fish, if you mm-hmm. cherish an environment, if you cherish habitat, and you fight for that, you'll see that you're going to accomplish a lot more in education and in spreading the good news of that environment, that fish, whatever it is you want to pursue, that passion. You know, that's the part where you're going to make a bigger difference than anybody pushing a pencil. And that's the thing that is just so, so important to know that voice is important and everybody has one, especially this day and age. I mean, social media, for better or for worse, I mean, you're seeing native trout become a little bit more popular in the social media platforms just simply because now everybody can kind of show off what they caught. And people are like, whoa, I didn't even know that was a thing. So it's really cool to see more of an emphasis put there. So it does have its merit. But do know that even as it pertains to our local species here in Texas, that, you know, we can fight for the water still. That's something that we can still fight for water. Texas is growing so fast, mm-hmm. the land's pretty hard to come by. But water, there's so much of that that's public for you and me that deserves protection and deserves conservation.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do with our expeditions and things like that. And those you guys are fighting for, and it's, you know, it's just an inspiring thing, you know. And I'm you know, most people in that I deal with in like the hunting realm, especially, and most and a lot of anglers are more maybe generally conservative minded politically or whatever. And I certainly am in most issues, but I get sick of people. I've had people think, well, you're an animal rights activist now because you're talking about clean water. No, I just don't want to end up in a cancer hospital. You know, I like to have clean air. I want, you know, Chris, where I learned about the idea of clean water was a gully by my house, a little stream. My dad said, you can fish down there. We're not going to eat anything that's in there because of this horrible pollution that was going down there. And there was like a factory that was putting these dyes in the water, and it was really in carcinogens and stuff, you know? And I learned my first lesson of pollution in fishing. And I knew if we want to eat the fish and harvest the fish and enjoy a great fishery, we need to have clean water. I didn't learn that from a classroom or a bureaucrat. I learned that from my dad in a fishing hole by the house.
Absolutely. Same here, man. I mean, the creek that I grew up fishing, my grandparents had a place down in Ciblo, and they had fish kills due to San Antonio dumping a bunch of stuff in the water one time. And it was a horrible deal. And it's just one of those deals that they ran into these conservation issues that were very real, very present. And that's something that, you see that as a kid and it sticks with you. And I forget which city it was that actually had the spill. I don't remember which one on the Ciblo, but I do know this. And that was my grandpa still telling me about that and going, you know, we're just now seeing this fish start to come back. You know, all that evidence was anecdotal. I don't think anybody ever ran an electroshock boat or a kit through there.
Sure.
I mean, it's one of those things that he noticed it for fishing. And that's the part where there is a little bit of, I'm going to say, well, there's a ton of value in anecdotal evidence from citizen science. People being out there going, hey, there's a problem. And sometimes that's the first warning sign we have when biologists aren't out in the field, you know, every moment of the day. Sometimes our anglers realize that, hey, there's a problem here. And that's something that's where the red flag goes up and gets the attention of the departments that need to go out and give it the look that it deserves.
And I believe it's going to be even more important in this post-COVID-19 thing, because I really don't think our economic chickens have completely come home to roost yet. And there's already been surveys canceled and lots of things in a scientific realm. And if, you know, hopefully the economy bounces back, but if we have another wave of this and we have more closures, there is going to be people let go in fish and game departments around the nation. And they're going to be maybe an even more important role for that citizen science, the concerned guy, to say, hey, we can take up some slack by reporting this and helping this and really being more engaged than ever.
And that's the truth. And I mean, and the other part about that is, I mean, there's a lot of people that listen to this that are landowners. You know, it starts with your own property. You know, doing what you can with, you know, the ranch you've got, the little homestead you got. I don't care if it's, you know, doing what you can on your front yard and your backyard, you know, being conscious about, you know, what you put on the grass, you know, what you, you know, what kind of stuff you're spraying, how close are you to the creek? Where does it drain? You know, all that sort of stuff. I mean, and that's one of the deals that we run into with urban fisheries, that it does get very, very complicated and very convoluted in a hurry. But with that, you know, we can make a difference, you know, one place at a time, one person at a time. And it is important.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. Now, let's say someone wants to take up this kind of fishing. You know, there's two different ways to do this. You can go fish with ultralight spin cast, which I love, or get involved in fly fishing. People can kind of figure out the spin cast part, but the fly fishing part, if someone wants to start fly fishing and maybe go after the Guadalupe rainbow trout, or maybe they're listening in one of these other states like Nevada or Utah or wherever and going after their native trout, what's the best thing to do? They need to go get some lessons. Would that really help them?
Lessons are by far one of the things that if you learn from a really good casting instructor, that's the part that's probably the best money invested in the sport. Because if you learn the true five essentials of fly casting, you go through that, you learn from a instructor that's well-versed in it, wherever they are, whether it be here or anywhere else, you know, wherever you're listening, find a good certified instructor or a good casting instructor. And, man, I'll tell you what, it'll shave years off your learning curve. And then getting a guided trip, you know, kind of doing that as a 1-2 punch. That's a really great way to kind of get the casting under your belt and immediately turn around and learn how to make that work on the water. And one of the things that we really try to do within our store is, we try to guide all public water if at all possible within the state of Texas, and that's the other part that's so special.
When we come back on More Outdoors, we're going to talk about something very unique, the potential of genetic hog control. Yes, genetic hog population control. Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. This is Chester Moore. This final segment is going to be one of the more interesting things you've ever heard in the great outdoors. I know that's a big statement, but look, I'm used to making big statements, and this one comes from years of being a wildlife and fisheries investigator. Back in the spring, we talked with a group called Revive and Restore, and we talked with Ben Novak, one of the scientists there, and they are involved with the cloning of the black-footed ferret. We had a whole show dedicated to the cloning of the black-footed ferret. Literally, cloning technology, taking a specimen that died in the 80s that isn't part of the current genetic makeup of the black-footed ferret, and they've made a cloned black-footed ferret. Well, as I got to thinking about this cloning technology, I circled back with Novak and asked him about the potential of controlling feral hog populations through genetic tinkering. Because when I hear of a technology like this, the first thing that I think of is like, okay, where could this go? And there's a lot of places this could go. I'm thinking about bringing back mammoths, which is kind of the obvious thing people talk about. There's actually a group dedicated to bringing back the woolly mammoth. But I thought in terms of wildlife populations, this would be an interesting one. And whether you agree with the technology or not, you're going to be fascinated by what you're about to hear with Ben Novak of Revive and Restore on genetically altering feral hogs to control populations.
Look, let's talk about an invasive animal like a feral hog that causes a lot of damage to a lot of animals' habitat. Could it be possible to create some kind of a genetic line of feral hogs introduced into a population, let's say maybe on an island where they're causing a lot of problems?
Yeah.
And they're more susceptible to heart disease or something else natural out there that maybe they have immunity to. Has that ever been thought about? Has that been discussed in terms of in the genetic conservation community?
It's actually probably the hottest topic right now.
Yeah.
in the biotech conservation space. Mm-hmm. It's heavily controversial, and there's a lot of
sure.
debates going on with how to tackle it, because there are some potential solutions to these invasive species that mm-hmm. that, you know, have some big pros and some potential serious cons.
Yeah.
I definitely fall into a particular camp that is not really a part of the debates a lot. Happy to share that here. But yeah, like feral hogs, feral goats mm-hmm. on islands cause huge amounts of problems for native wildlife. Mm-hmm. And feral rodents too. And right now the best means of going out and eliminating those populations is by actually going out rifle in hand.
It happens all the time here. I'm trying to kill them on my property because we like to barbecue them here in Texas. So,
and it's tough, right? I mean,
yes.
A feral animal can go anywhere a human being cannot.
Exactly.
People are using choppers on islands to go get these animals.
Yeah,
the thing is,
tough.
You leave one pregnant female,
it's over. They're going to come back in a year.
and you have to do it all over again. The alternate is, you know, poison and toxins.
Yeah.
And it works, but inevitably you're going to lose some collateral damage.
For sure.
You know, some native species that you want around are going to be there. Mm-hmm. And either method, you know, is ultimately not humane. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm a hunter myself. There's no one in the world that can provide an incredibly swift kill on a wild animal. We can do it better than any predator mm-hmm. in the world. You know, we're not tearing animals up.
I've taken some
claws.
Hogs out pretty quick, but
yeah. but it is impossible to just like humanely yeah. do it the way a veterinarian does mm-hmm. in a clinic, right? And toxins are the far worse option
by, you know, far. Yeah, there's a lot of controversy over that in Texas right now with the USDA test and stuff like that. You know, a lot of division on that. But I had to ask about the genetic. Just is that even a possibility
yeah.
in the future?
So the big pro to these new potential genetic solutions, things like gene drives, is that they're humane. Animals don't end up dying horrible deaths, and the animal spreads the solution for you. You don't, as a human being, need to try and find every nook and cranny these animals get to, because the animals are simply spreading the tool by breeding. And the most popular version of this is what's called a sex biasing gene drive. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be gene drive either. I'll explain the difference. The idea of a drive is that, you know, when a male breeds and has offspring, in mammals, he passes on the Y chromosome, which makes males. Mm-hmm. Half of his offspring become male, half are female. And that's usually how it goes with every gene, right? You got a 50% chance of getting it from your mom or your dad. A gene drive, which happened naturally, there's ways, these are selfish genes, mm-hmm. genes that figure out a way to bypass the system, will actually be inherited at rates of anywhere from 60 to 70 to 95%. They figure out a way to beat the odds. And with CRISPR-Cas9 technologies, we now have the power to actually harness and do that ourselves, where we could take the genes that make a male and make them actually duplicate themselves into all the offspring, so that even the genetically female offspring end up inheriting a male gene mm-hmm. and become male. So over several generations, the entire population becomes male mm-hmm. and just dies out after the last generation, you know, lives out its life expectancy. And so that's a really attractive option. But people are always worried that, okay, well, what if one of these gene drive animals escapes the island where you want to eradicate them
sure.
and gets to somewhere where you actually want those animals around?
Yeah.
How do you build in safeguards? Now, there's ways to actually prevent and slow that spread. There's other options that don't drive. There's something called, the W shredder, where you would actually design CRISPR-Cas9 on the Y chromosome that goes out and actually attacks and cuts up the W chromosome, so that only Y-carrying sperm end up mm-hmm. passing on, and you once again get only males. But it's a little slower to build up in the population. There's a lot of different mechanisms for it. Ultimately, I think a lot of people are forgetting that we don't have to build in genetic barriers at a molecular level for to make all of this stuff safe. Mm-hmm. Biosecurity measures do work. There are islands out there in the world where feral rats or goats or other animals have been eradicated the old-fashioned way mm-hmm. and have been free of those for decades now, because people put biosecurity measures in place to prevent those animals from getting back mm-hmm. to those places. You know, I think a combination of using landscape and human intervention and these gene drives will be able to allow us to implement these in the wild in a very restricted, localized way to humanely and effectively control our invasive species, which is one of the biggest problems we have to deal with mm-hmm. right now on mm-hmm. islands, especially, but also, you know,
oh, sure.
on the mainland, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just mention, because islands not only have, you know, you mentioned the feral hogs, like rats up in somewhere in the yeah. Pacific, there are areas where Norway rats have showed up because of ships and foxes and all kind of stuff. And have ruined bird populations and different things like that. So,
you know, it's shared techniques and whatnot, but you know, yeah, these biotechnologies create these extremely different potential avenues for helping wild species.
It's certainly a fascinating topic and one that we're going to explore more. You know, back in 2018, when I published my book called The Conserve, I have an entire chapter called Brave New World that involves GMOs, genetic tinkering, and all of this kind of stuff. And we have to confront these questions in the outdoors world. I know it's not, you know, typically talking about where to go fishing or where to go hunting, but I'm telling you, the things that I'm talking about now are going to be the issues, not in 20 years, but in 5 to 10 years. This is going to be a major issue at the very forefront of hunting and fishing, wildlife management, forestry, you name it, we're going to have to confront it. And that's one of the reasons I like to have programs like this here on More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. So you go, hey, I heard about that. Let me make an informed decision. That's what's going to really take informed decisions. Just remember, you heard it here first on More Outdoors with Chester Moore here on News Talk 560 KLVI. And I always appreciate everyone checking out these programmings that may be atypical for outdoors programs, or maybe they're the reason we win so many awards and are blessed to be honored by different prestigious outdoors organizations. At KLVI.com, click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Proud to say we were big winners in the prestigious Press Club of Southeast Texas Awards. First place for radio public service announcement, and first place for investigative shows about our mysterious horse killings programs. Thank you so much for listening. God bless, and have a great outdoors weekend.